From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Crowds cheered, the national colors flew, and on Sunday, Jair Bolsonaro, a retired military officer with a fondness for military dictatorship and a distaste for minorities, the LGBT community, and women, celebrated his election as the next president of Brazil. And with that, the world's fifth most populous nation joined the community of countries led today by some brand of populist authoritarian leader. By one measure, more than half the world now is ruled by outright dictatorships or authoritarian governments. So this hour on Point, the age of the strongman. And you can join us. What's driving the rise of the populist strongman? Do you welcome it or fear the consequences? Why do you think the goal of democratic consensus is in retreat? And if this feels like the right way to lead now, the only way to get things done, do you ever worry that the strongman might use his strength against you? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Now, we will talk a lot about the global trends in democracy and the pushback against democracy. But first of all, let's take stock of what happened in Brazil this weekend. And joining me now from the capital, Brasilia, is Ray Collett, Brasilia Bureau Chief for Bloomberg News. Ray, welcome to On Point.
Thank you so much, Meghna.
So first of all, describe to us how significant is the fact that Jair Bolsonaro won the presidential election in Brazil. It does seem to be a profound shift to the right for what is by far South America's largest democracy.
It's a tectonic shift, frankly. It's the first time that a right-wing government comes to power since Brazil returned to democracy in 1985. It's also the first time that the left-wing party, the Workers' Party of Lula, lost since 2002. So it's clearly a move that takes Brazil, Latin America's largest nation, into an entirely different direction. What remains to be seen is to what extent the rest of the country goes along. We also know that Jair Bolsonaro had a very high rejection rate, above 40%. So he has come to power in part because of this huge rejection with the traditional political class, but at the same time, not everybody is with him.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit more about Bolsonaro himself. He's a former member of the Brazilian military, member of the Brazilian in Congress, but until recently was dismissed as unelectable because of his long history of saying divisive things, to say the least.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, racist slurs, some despicable comments about women, things you don't necessarily want to repeat. What's particularly odd about him is that for 28 years, nearly three decades, he sat in Congress, sort of a backbencher who nobody had heard of, and he hadn't really done anything worth remembering. And all of a sudden, he manages to brand himself as an outsider, having sat in Congress for almost three decades. I am not part of the traditional political elite. Please elect me. So that's one of the oddities of this entire election, that he has rebranded himself successfully, in part using social media very intelligently, in part with these controversial comments. And there we are. People simply didn't want to go back to the leftist government that was in place. People were unsatisfied with traditional politicians, and he was the next best thing.
Right. Well, so, I mean, to the point that you're making about his controversial past and the things he said, it is quite striking, to say the least, what he has said before. But I do want to give people a sense of it. So we're going to play a little bit of tape here of Jair Bolsonaro and his past statements. He'll obviously be speaking in Portuguese, and I will read a little bit about a little translation of what Bolsonaro has said. So in this montage, you're hearing Bolsonaro say things such as, "I'm in favor of torture, you know that." To a woman, he once said, "I would never rape you because you don't deserve it." He told a talk show panel, "When your son starts getting a bit gay, you slap him and he changes his behavior." And then he once described visiting a community of black descendants of slaves in Brazil and said the lightest Afro-Brazilian weighed more than 200 pounds. They don't do anything. On the other hand, though, Ray Collett, Bolsonaro, after his election, seemed to sound a more conciliatory tone. Here's part of his victory speech.
As a defender of freedom, I will lead a government that defends and protects the rights of the citizens that fulfill their obligations and respect the law. The law is for all, because that is the way our government will be, constitutional and democratic.
Ray Collett, how much of a conciliatory tone did he strike, and do people believe him? Because I understand he also gave a very recent interview earlier this week, saying that he would actively try to shut down, for example, one of Sao Paulo's most crusading newspapers.
Yeah, well, this is the $6 million question, isn't it? There's so far very little of the new Bolsonaro and still a lot of the old Bolsonaro. So it's not quite clear to what extent he has changed, how deep that change is. The Sunday night acceptance speech was at the very least welcomed by investors, by the investment financial community who saw at least the willingness to move in the right direction. But that's, you know, it's going to take more than an acceptance speech to convince millions of people who have Brazil's dictatorship still in memory. Again, it's only been 30 years.
Right.
There's been testimony by survivors, by people who've been tortured, and that concern is not going to go away so fast. He does seem to thrive on you know, as I say, the provocation against traditional media, against minorities. I'd venture to say it's beginning to change, but again, only time will tell, and we'll have to see over the next couple of weeks and months how that's going to play out.
But Ray, I mean, I think we cannot underscore enough that Jair Bolsonaro's victory didn't come out of nowhere, right? I mean, he was also speaking very forcefully to the corruption that the Brazilian government has been seized by for many years, right? I mean, we have two presidents who've been impeached. One has gone to jail. Brazil's current leader indicted on corruption charges.
Yeah, yeah.
A third of the lower house under investigation for corruption. And that in combination with violence on the streets of several Brazilian cities that people have just had enough of. I mean, he was able to put together a coalition of fed up Brazilians that put him into office.
I'm surprised when I hear people saying we're surprised by Bolsonaro. I said, how could you be surprised? Anybody watching Brazil in the last couple of years cannot be surprised by this. The writing was on the wall. I mean, a country that has seen for 3 years, Brazilians have seen on their television screens one politician after another, one business leader after another going to jail with bags of money in their suitcases. There are people in the streets, mothers with children on the way to school who get shot, some accidentally, some not. There are people who've been, millions of people have been out of jobs. We spoke to university professors. One described to us how a PhD in biology was selling brownies in the streets because there were no more scholarships and there were no jobs. So, you know, and add to that, this sense of, so we have recession, we have crime, we have corruption. You know, you add all that together and you have, you know, the perfect recipe for someone like Bolsonaro to take advantage of it.
Well, Ray Collett, Brasilia Bureau Chief for Bloomberg News, thank you so much for joining us today, Ray.
Thank you.
All right. Well, I want to expand this conversation a little bit and talk about what Brazil's election of Jair Bolsonaro tells us about this global trend of authoritarian strongmen. And joining us now is Larry Diamond. He's professor of sociology and political science at Stanford University, also a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution. He's founding co-editor of the Journal of Democracy and author of The Spirit of Democracy and the forthcoming book, Ill Winds, Saving Democracy from Russia Rage, Chinese Ambition and America Complacency. That's due out next year. And Larry Diamond joins us today from Stanford, California. Welcome to On Point, Larry.
Nice to be with you, Meghna.
So what do you see in the election of Jair Bolsonaro in Brazil, the fifth largest country in the world now, very handily putting a strongman into office?
Well, I see what Ray said, response to democracy that was crumbling in its performance. And I would say Brazilian public rage at everything Ray was talking about in terms of not just a recession, but a virtual economic depression in Brazil, a crime situation that has made Brazil home to seven of the 20 most violent cities in the world, And a corruption scandal, Meghna, that had just completely engulfed the entire political class in Brazil across the highly fragmented party system. People wanted very, very deep change. I believe if there had emerged from the creative center or entirely outside the system a more responsible cleansing alternative, that person might have gotten elected, but the only alternative that made it into the runoff was the same left workers' party that had run the country for the last four presidential terms.
So is this part of a global pattern you see here, that in you name the nation where people had a choice, they didn't see the emergence of an alternative voice, and instead, followed the loudest, most powerful voice, which has been coming from the authoritarian right?
Well, it's a rising trend,
yeah.
And it's an alarming one. I mean, in Greece, they turned to the populist left rather than the populist
mm-hmm.
right.
Mm-hmm.
But and that could be a response, too. Look, as democracy was performing very badly and very manifestly corruptly in Venezuela now nearly a generation ago, they turned to another person who made his authoritarian intentions abundantly clear. In fact, he had organized two military coup attempts about 8, 9, 10 years before he was elected to the presidency. And of course, that is Hugo Chavez. And look what happened to democracy in Venezuela. So you've got to take this very seriously. I know you're going to want to talk about India and Narendra Modi.
Yep.
Certainly, we have to talk about the Philippines and Rodrigo Duterte, who again came in with contempt for democracy, openly and joyfully expressed.
Well, we'll explore all of those countries because the list is long and we want to look at what's happening around the world. Larry Diamond, stand by. We're talking about the rise of the strongman worldwide. We'll be right back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking about the rise and the rise worldwide of the authoritarian strongman, the latest of which happened this weekend in Brazil, where Jair Bolsonaro.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Bolsonaro, a right-wing candidate, was elected handily as the new president of Brazil. And we're joined today by Larry Diamond. He's professor of sociology and political science at Stanford University, founding co-editor of the Journal of Democracy and author of The Spirit of Democracy. And Larry, before we leave the question of Brazil behind and talk about these other nations, I actually want to get a call in here because we have a Brazilian voter. Michael is calling from Boston, Massachusetts. Michael, you're on the air.
Yes, hi, Meghna. I lived here in the U.S. forever. I'm a U.S. citizen. Voted for Bolsonaro this last Sunday, along with a bunch of other Brazilians that some of them are here illegal that suffer under quote-unquote Trump's politics. The way we see Bolsonaro is not the way we see Trump. We see Bolsonaro as a stamp against corruption. The way Brazil has been governed in the last God knows how many years, it's just not sustainable. The government machine there, it is massive, and the corruption goes beyond the higher echelons of government. It is spread out throughout society, and unfortunately, there were only two candidates that made it to the runoff, so you had to pick between, the worst or the least worst. And
right.
He was the option for many centrists that saw him as a venue for, or, as a vehicle for to lead this nation, this nation out of
it. Michael, sorry, I just to echo your point here. I was reading, for example, a quote in the Washington Post from a Sao Paulo dentist saying, if there had been another decent candidate, he wouldn't have voted for Bolsonaro. That Bolsonaro is a lot of garbage, but quote, he's the lesser of the evil. Saying exactly what you said there, Michael. But I've got another comment here from a different listener. Michael Gaskin says on Facebook to us, why do people feel that they must give a green light to racism, sexism, homophobia, and anti-environmentalism in order to fight crime and corruption? Bolsonaro brings all of the above, to say nothing of his fondness for state-sponsored murder. What's your response to this other listener, Michael?
I come from an African-Brazilian descent, so, from black grandparents. I have many gay friends that voted for Bolsonaro. Feminism, quote-unquote, argument against Bolsonaro, there are so many echoes to so many things he has said in the past. But for example, when you mentioned that lady that he, talked about, that particular deputy that he was arguing against, she was defending the killer that beheaded and raped a girl. Mm. He was livid against that situation. So he was so livid that a woman was not defending another fellow woman that was raped and beheaded. That is the level of conversation that he has to go against up in Brazil.
Yeah.
You're looking at people that go to jail, against these things that would get capital punishment here in the U.S. They'll go to jail, they'll serve, 3-4 years, and then they'll leave.
Right.
This young lady that killed her parents, she was able to get out of jail for a Mother's Day walk.
Michael, thank you for your call. I hear your passion there, and I want to hear Larry Diamond's response to that. Larry Diamond, Michael, very clearly saying that the problems in Brazil so overwhelming that both the more distasteful parts that he may not approve of in Bolsonaro fall by the wayside.
Well, I think it's great that Michael called in because we now have a direct expression of the frustration and anger that produced the victory for this extreme right and, I'd say, fairly explicitly authoritarian candidate. And the problem is that when you as a voter turn to or feel that you have little choice but to turn to such a blunt and savage instrument, as someone who has been so explicitly authoritarian and has expressed over the entire quarter century trajectory of his political career such frequent contempt for democracy, you're putting the whole democratic system, on the operating table. And we need to keep something in mind, Meghna, when we look at what's going on in the world now, but also the history of democratic failure in the world. Frequently, when you put in office in a failing or misperforming democratic system, someone who has been abundantly clear about his authoritarian intentions, he acts on them. And I'd say Brazilian democracy is at severe risk right now.
I want to play a little tape that may support exactly the point that you're saying, Larry Diamond. This takes us to the Philippines with President Rodrigo Duterte there, who has been very outspoken about his crackdown on drugs and violence there, to the point where, he advocates extrajudicial killings in the Philippines. And in 2016, he actually compared himself favorably to Adolf Hitler, saying that he would like to kill millions of drug dealers.
Hitler massacred 3 million Jews. Now, there is 3 million, there's a 3 million drug addicts. There are. I'd be happy to slaughter them.
That's Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte saying Hitler massacred 3 million Jews. Now there is 3 million drug dealers. I'd be happy to slaughter them. But Larry Diamond, we've got some comments coming here from listeners that wonder, you said that democracy may be end up on the operating table in these countries. But Sean Megan says, I think more than a little tongue in cheek, he says, I'm outraged that citizens of a foreign country can vote their free will. And someone calling themselves Yeti Ball says, is it really a pushback on democracy if the strong man in question is democratically elected in a legitimate election? What do you think?
Well, I'd say a few things. number one, Duterte actually has presided over the extrajudicial killing of well over 12,000 people on the streets of the Philippines. So when autocrats signal their intentions, we have to take them seriously. Secondly, although there's rising despair and cynicism about democracy in Brazil, there is not a majority sentiment to end democracy in Brazil, and that is certainly not what Brazilian voters want. I don't think it is what our previous caller, Michael, wanted. Mm-hmm. They just want decisive action to reform and cleanse the system. So you can say, yes, they voted for change. They certainly did. They voted for what they perceive to be, in the runoff election, the only option for real change that they had. But that doesn't give Bolsonaro license to close down the Congress, to close down the Supreme Court, as his son, who is also a congressman, suggested they might have to do, or to violate civil liberties. And I think Brazilians now need to be very organized and very vigilant, as we should be from the international community, in ensuring that Bolsonaro addresses Brazil's problems in a way that don't violate the Constitution and the rule of law.
Yeah. Well, Larry Diamond, let me just bring in another voice into this conversation. Laura King joins us. She joins us today from Washington. She's global affairs correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. Laura King, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Meghna.
It's great to have you, Laura. So let me just ask you, I mean, you've heard Larry talk about what he sees as some of the threats to democracy, long-term threats to democracy, with the rise of these authoritarian leaders around the world. I'm just wondering if you see any sort of, or what are the unifying features that you see in what brought them to power? I mean, the situation on the ground in each of these countries is slightly different, but it seems to be that, to me, that one of the things that defines all of these leaders, and I would include Donald Trump among them, is this call, this strong call to an us versus them political language that has resonated in each of these countries. Do you buy that?
Yes, I certainly think that's true. I think you see a denigration of minority rights, the rule of law, erosions of press freedom and human rights. Those all seem to be kind of common factors in all of these countries. And in terms of what it's in response to, I guess there are a lot of theories about that. But it seems that cultural and social change is threatening to a large segment of the society in all of these countries.
What are the consequences to that then? If the response is to, or it's seemingly in this moment, the response is to elect an authoritarian leader.
Well, the consequences are a continuation of all of these trends that helped bring them to power. And of course, you see things like a leader engaging in lying with impunity, and that in itself is a projection of power, and I think you continue to see things like the demonization of migrants, of immigrants, and of minority groups within a society.
Yeah, you know, I wonder, Larry Diamond, are we basically at a point now where what we're seeing is just a very profound reminder or reality check that democratic systems aren't necessarily the norm in terms of how human beings have governed themselves over time, and that perhaps we're going back to something that precedes the past 50, 60 or 70 years, where the thought that liberal democracies, you know, the whole end of history theory from Francis Fukuyama, that we're seeing the reality of that we're just going back to previous ways of governing ourselves, when 53%, according to one group, 53% of the world is living under either dictatorial or authoritative regimes.
Well, you're absolutely right in what you said, and I would phrase it this way, which I show in my forthcoming book. First of all, there's a rising tide of democratic failures in the world, and this is not in the last year or two. This has been in the last decade. And second of all, if you go back, Meghna, to the entire 40-year stretch of what Samuel Huntington called the third wave of global democratization that started in the mid-1970s and that Brazil was a part of in the mid-1980s, Nearly 40% of all the democracies that have existed during this period have failed. And the tide of failure, I repeat, is rising. So there's nothing to guarantee that this season of democracy that we've been living through, particularly since the end of the Cold War, is going to persist. We've got serious and rising frustrations with democracy in both advanced industrial countries and emerging market countries and poor countries. And we've got a lot of work to do to repair and reform democracy in Brazil and in the United States and to make it work better and more responsively.
Right. So, Laura King, what's your thought on that point?
Well, following on what Professor Diamond just said, I do think it's certainly important to note that just a decade ago, some places that were considered kind of bright spots, hopeful spots in terms of democratic development, places like Turkey or Hungary now are very much part of this trend of backsliding into autocracy.
Well, I mean, speaking of Hungary here, let's just play a little bit of tape from Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban. Last March, he was delivering a speech on the 170th anniversary of the revolutions of 1848. And we'll listen to him a little, and then I will read you his words, because if you listen carefully, you will hear some classic themes of authoritarian leaders. So Viktor Orban saying, we must fight against an opponent which is different from us. Their faces are not visible, but are hidden from view. They do not fight directly, but by stealth. They are not honorable, but unprincipled. They are not national, but international. They do not believe in work, but speculate with money. They have no homeland, but feel that the whole world is theirs. That's Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban last March. I mean, Larry Diamond, we talked about the failures of democracy and perhaps globalization. Of globalization as well. But there's also this endless fear-mongering and othering that we're seeing with each of these leaders as well.
Well, yes, because it seems to work electorally. And look, in human history, demagogues have always ridden to power by playing on fear in difficult times. And it takes creative, responsible, resourceful democratic leadership to provide the alternative, whether it's FDR in 1932 when the rest of the world was or much of the rest of the world was turning to fascism, or, you know, Angela Merkel, who's now announced that she's leaving, providing a continuing, steadying kind of moral center in Germany. Macron emerged at the last minute in France, or who knows, maybe Le Pen would have won in France. So, you know, in the end, Meghna, it comes down to politics, and it always involves alternatives. And if democracy is going to counter the temptations of authoritarian demagoguery, they have to put forward alternatives.
Yeah. So Laura King, talk to me about that a little bit, because I think Angela Merkel and Emmanuel Macron, as Larry Diamond pointed out, are terrific examples of how even when you have non-authoritarian leaders, leaders who very vociferously still believe in the power of liberal democracy, they have to still manage what's a growing restlessness in their own electorate and disappointment. I mean, Macron's popularity, I think, is quite low right now in France.
Yeah, I do think that leaders like this, even in countries that we consider to be pretty securely democratic, are certainly feeling the pressure from the right, and in some cases having to adjust some of their own positions to deal with that. And that I think is kind of an unfortunate trend. And then the overall weakness at the moment of the European Union is also very worrying, because it's less able to serve as a check on some of the undemocratic and illiberal practices in places like Poland and Hungary and other countries in Central and Eastern Europe.
Yeah. I mean, Larry Diamond, I'm seeing here that we just got a minute to go before the break, but Yasha Munk recently wrote that we should not trust in any single, quote, democratic messiahs to deliver us from or deliver people from the, quote, many devils lurking in the shadows. So if we – he's saying saying that we can't look to a more sort of centrist, less authoritarian leader to rise in the face of these forces. So where should we look? What should we look for?
He said not to look to a messiah. I don't think anyone ever accused Angela Merkel of presenting herself as a messiah.
Point taken.
We've got to revive democratic politics, and I put the word on politics. And that means not only Meghna individuals with fresh reform ideas, but also reforms. And we should talk about that in the context of Brazil. The system is deeply broken.
Well, we're speaking with Larry Diamond. He's professor of sociology and political science at Stanford University. Laura King also joins us. She's global affairs correspondent for the LA Times. We're talking about the rise of the global strongman. We'll be right back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about the rise and the rise of the authoritarian leader around the world. Most recently, Jair Bolsonaro, who won the Brazilian election on Sunday handily. We're joined today by Larry Diamond. He's professor of sociology and political science at Stanford University, also a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution, and author of the forthcoming book, Ill Winds, Saving Democracy from Russia Rage, Chinese Ambition, and American Complacency. That's due out next year. Laura King also joins us. She's global affairs correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. Lots of people want to join us, Larry and Laura, so let me just get some callers in here. Alice is calling from Norwalk, Connecticut. Alice, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. It's been reported that Steve Bannon was an advisor to Bolsonaro in his bid for the presidency. And as you know, he was chief strategist for Donald Trump in his 2016 presidential election. I'm kind of appalled by the fact that Trump utilized him, given the fact that Bannon is, as he says, a populist, but in my opinion, is actually a white nationalist. Mm. And I wondered what your guests thought about his influence in this election. It's disturbing to me that he also supported Marine Le Pen and, you know, her bid for her election in France.
Well, Alice, since you asked a good question, let me let our panelists respond. Thank you for your call. Laura King, Steve Bannon is still working to spread populism throughout the world. What influence or role did he have to play, if any, in Brazil?
Well, in terms of Brazil, I'm not so well versed in that, okay. But I would say that one thing that's been interesting about Mr. Bannon is that he's encountered some rejection and some resistance from even some of the European nationalists with whom he's seeking to make an alliance. Some of them are in effect just telling him to stay out of it, and that does kind of reflect their sense of a homegrown tradition.
But didn't I
taking
see
the, precedence?
Didn't I read though that Matteo Salvini, Italy's deputy prime minister, actually joined Bannon's organization called The Movement that he founded to spread populist politics and basically undermine the European Union. That just happened recently, right?
Well, Mr. Bannon, I think, has sought actively to export his what he did for Mr. Trump to Europe, and that has pretty much been a driving force behind what he's been doing since he left the White House.
I see. So let's go to Jill, who's calling from St. Helena Island, South Carolina. Jill, you're on the air.
Hi, Meghna. I just wanted to say that strong-arm tactics may work in the short term. However, they're not sustainable over a long time. You may get a few quick wins, but the only way to move forward and not end up in a stalemate is to actually put the time in, build relationships with the people you need to work with. Even if you look in business, if you're doing a process redesign, you need to get buy-in from all members of the team. And if you don't, and you skip that work of relationship building, you're always going to have people working to undermine progress, even if the progress benefits everyone.
Mm. Jill, thank you for your call. Larry Diamond, do politicians have the time, though, to build those relationships, to garner that consensus that Jill is talking about? It's requisite for a successful democracy.
Well, Meghna, I'd like to take it back to Brazil, if I may. I think the question is not time, but structural incentives, particularly if you want to make government work, which really in part requires making Congress work. We have our own challenges here in the United States, but it's important that we not close the hour without noting a fundamental structural impediment to decent governance in Brazil, which is that you've got now 21 parties sitting in the Senate, 30 parties sitting in the Congress. Both are records for Brazilian democracy, at least in the current era. And because of this extreme system of proportional representation, one reason why you've had so much corruption in Brazil is that presidents need to throw around money corruptly in order to assemble congressional majorities out of this mix. And as the former president, Fernando Henrique Cardoso, said, they've got to fix this system and create a more rational, smaller party Congress.
Mm. Laura King, so just if I can, I mean, we've been focusing on Brazil a lot because it's, Larry rightly points out, it's just happened and there's a lot of specific things to talk about regarding Brazil at the moment. But, you know, I should have done this earlier, Laura, and I'm sorry that I didn't. But I was wondering if you could just sort of briefly tell us what countries you would consider, you know, part of this rise of the strongman trend we've seen. We've talked about the Philippines. We've talked about Brazil. We, you know, mentioned the United States, even Russia, China. What else would you include in that list?
Well, I did have a chance to spend time recently in Poland and Hungary, and I would certainly count them among this trend. And I would say I'm still in touch with some people in Egypt and Turkey from the time that I spent there when I lived in those countries. And there's a sense of real alarm and a real sense that things are getting worse and worse.
So Turkey and Egypt as well. Okay. Now, Larry earlier in the hour mentioned Modi in India. Does he fall into this category?
Oh, I think so, definitely.
Okay. And Larry, what do you think?
I think Modi is in no way as blatant a foe of democracy as Bolsonaro is. Modi, you know, really believes and invests in elections and has never spoken about closing down democracy. But he's certainly leaning hard on opposition and on civil liberties. And that's a warning sign to really watch carefully.
Mm. Well, let's go to Connie, who's calling from Seattle, Washington. Connie, you're on the air.
Hi, Meghna. I was wondering how much of this might be a reaction to the global women's movement that we've been seeing recently. I know in Central and South America, it's quite a macho culture. I don't know if there's some anxiety around the women's movement. I know women's movement also advocates for other civil rights causes, can be a threat to authoritarian strongmen dictatorships. So I didn't know you have a sociologist there. Is he seeing anything, and could this be some kind of a effective reaction to that movement globally?
Connie, thanks for your call. Larry Diamond, what do you think?
I think that earlier there was a reference to the threat from cultural and social change that's driving a lot of this authoritarian reaction. And it's not only three decades or more of the women's rights movement, but gay rights and immigrant rights and so on. But I don't think this can explain the immediate success of Bolsonaro or other right-wing alternatives. It's very much a response as well to economic distress, economic insecurity, and a general failure of government. So what the caller described is just one of many strands of unease and reaction.
Mm. Let's go to Peggy, who's calling from Springfield, Illinois. Peggy, you're on the air.
Yes. I've hearing people talk about disillusion with globalization. And from my observation, I think we've made a terrible, terrible mistake in equating our democracy with the kind of hard-edged capitalism that we are now living under when it operates globally.
Mm. Peggy,
and I think the disillusion has been terrible because democracy is something everyone wants, but then when we say we've got it and it's causing chaos and inequality, people get very disillusioned.
Yeah. Peggy, thank you for your call because it's a very important point. Laura King, respond to what Peggy said, because I think the key thing that Peggy highlights is that she feels that there's been an equation or a perceived equation between democracy means a particular form of hard-edged capitalism spread globally, and it's the failure of that we're seeing as driving some of the rise of these authoritarian regimes.
Well, I certainly think that income inequity is a danger sign that a lot of groups that monitor democratic freedoms point to. And I think another really important factor in this, another economic factor, is corruption as a cause and a consequence of authoritarianism. You have a strongman leader who wants to protect his cronies, protect his or her financial interests. And so that I think is very much of a factor.
Yeah. Larry Diamond, your thoughts on globalization and democracy, or the pushback against democratic norms?
I think that it is a significant contributing factor to the rising tide of illiberal and, in many cases, authoritarian populism. It is contributing both to the rising economic insecurity of working and middle class people, and to the sense of losing popular sovereignty, losing control. But of course, the irony is that these extreme right-wing figures who are surfacing now don't have an answer to the challenge of globalization, and particularly to rising economic inequality. And when you get someone like Bolsonaro, who thinks in simplistic terms that the only solution is to unleash the market and shred the safety net that, in fact, previous governments have tried to extend and that has reduced poverty as a result in Brazil, it's not going to work. And I think there's going to be a massive reaction against what Bolsonaro does or fails to do in the coming years. But the question, again, is what price will democracy pay before then?
Well, so Larry, let me ask you about that, because I'm taken by your point that that people who want to resist the rise of authoritarianism, other politicians don't, as you said, don't have the answers yet about how to address appropriately the ills that, say, globalization has brought to many people around the world. But now that we have these authoritarian regimes rising, does this problem of finding the answers become even more challenging because strongmen can exert a lot of pressure? They can change the rules of the political game as needed. Technology makes it even easier to do that by reaching directly to people? Has it just become that much harder to find the answers?
Meghna, I don't think the search for the policy answers is made harder by the rise of these illiberal potential autocrats. I mean, the policy challenges remain and are urgent, and it's to some extent an intellectual challenge as well as a political challenge. But the specifically political challenge has been made more difficult and more urgent because they're not only posing a policy threat to, I think, social justice, economic fairness, and creative new challenges of reviving economic growth, they're putting civil liberties, the rule of law, and potentially democracy itself at risk. So some of the political and intellectual energy that we might have just devoted in a normal political situation to finding creative policy directions, we now need to invest in just defending democracy.
Well, let's take one more call here. Rob is calling from Jefferson City, Missouri. Rob, you're on the air.
Hi, Meghna. Thank you. My only comment is that I live in a state that used to be a bellwether that went for Trump by 19 points. And one of the things I repeatedly hear from voters around this state when I ask them why they voted for Trump is that they essentially crave an authoritarian voice, because I don't think they understand that the political process is what it is. They wanted somebody that basically reached over it or cut through it, and I don't think they necessarily understand the consequences of that. And I'm curious to what your panel thinks in terms of how we overcome just a lack of curiosity and understanding that a multi-party system is going to be like that.
Rob, thank you for your call. Laura King, do you have an answer for him?
I think that's such a good question. I mean, democracy is work. It's hard work. And it is kind of a shortcut to fall into line with a strong man who promises that he alone can solve things. And this is a common theme that we hear in countries that are headed in this direction.
Now, Larry Diamond and Laura King, I want to ask you both a sort of final question inspired by something that Ian Bremmer recently wrote. And we've had him on the program not that long ago because he has his book out, apologizing for his own sort of belief in unfettered globalization. But he recently wrote about this sort of rise of the strongman worldwide. And he ended his article by saying that he's most concerned about what's going to happen in the future. He says the systems that powered the Cold War's winners now look much less appealing than they did a generation ago. Why even emulate the U.S. or European political systems with checks and balances that prevent even the most determined leaders from taking on chronic problems when one determined leader can offer credible shortcuts to greater security and national pride? And then Bremmer says, as long as that rings true, the greatest threat may be the strongmen yet to come. Larry Diamond, what do you think?
Well, I think we need to, first of all, show the consequences of the strongman's triumph, which are, in fact, if you look at Turkey, economic disarray, the loss of civil liberties, and even more massive corruption. Or look at the logical conclusion of all of this, which is the near state collapse you see in Venezuela now. And the other half of the coin, I repeat, Meghna, is that Democrats, and by this I mean Democrats, Republicans, Libertarians, anyone who believes in constitutional government, they both have to proffer more viable solutions to our challenges, and they need to find ways to cooperate legislatively to enact them.
Yeah. Well, Laura King, we've got about 20 seconds left. Do you want to share a last thought with us?
Yeah, I agree that there could be a backlash. The pendulum could swing because one of the consequences of authoritarianism is greater instability and some bad economic consequences as well. So perhaps we'll see a reaction to that.
But maybe ideally we wouldn't even have to get to that point. But I hear what you're saying, Laura. Laura King, global affairs correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. Thank you so much for joining us today. And Larry Diamond, professor of sociology and political science at Stanford University and author of The Spirit of Democracy. Larry, pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you.
Thank you, Meghna.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.